move the handy-talkie around the room, left, right, up, down, forward, and back, and you find the place where you get the strongest reception. That's not always the place where you get the strongest transmission, because the transmitting frequency is slightly different. You might find with experimentation, you have to move to a slightly different position or slightly different orientation in order for it to hear you well on transmission. But a little bit of experimenting, you'll find that out. Let me drop this. On top of that, the terrain can do some funny things. This repeater, for instance, is purely vertically polarized on transmission and reception. And by the time that signal bounces off all of the water towers, buildings, trees, everything else, to get the 25 miles to my house, my bathroom, I have to mount my handy-talkie horizontal on a plastic shelf in order to get best reception. The signal, by the time it gets to my bathroom, is horizontally polarized. And as strange as that sounds, it's something that can happen. So when it comes to finding the best position for either receiving or transmitting, don't be afraid to try left, right, up, down, forward, back, and changing polarization. Depending on the way that signal bounces, a purely vertical signal transmitted could arrive horizontally polarized when it gets to your bathroom, if you know what I mean. Bob wants to make his comment. Bob, number one. Good to meet you, J-O-B. Not Bob. Number one. Go ahead, Bob. K2RIW.
Dick, I just wanted to comment. I agree with you 100%. The antenna that comes with the radio is substantially better than some of the ones you can buy. I've run some tests using Nygomas, MFJs, and actually the performance was degraded with those antennas versus the antenna that came with the radio. I'm not sure which radio the other Bob has over there, but if it's an HT type, it has an SMA connector on it. In addition to any antenna that you're going to put with it, it'll need an adapter from a SO239 to a SMA connector on there. So I'm not quite sure what the termination on his radio is, but I agree with you. And I think the 13 miles and with elevation, probably the antenna that's on the radio is probably going to do the job, Dick. Back to you.
Yeah, that was Bob number one, and I agree with you. Unless you've got some pretty rough terrain, 13 miles is usually a good distance into a repeater with a handy-talkie. If it's a self-respecting repeater, 5 watts, 13 miles, with a relatively clear terrain and some altitude, that should work like gangbusters. Particularly when you find the right position to hold that handy-talkie.
There's another alternative. This island has a beach kind of between two halves of an island, maybe like think of a barbell, it's like a double beach. So possibly the beach is another good place, even though it's lower, but it's got like clear water ahead, you know, depending which direction. and that is the beach on both sides. It's like a strip of beach between almost like two islands, if you think of it. That's where we'll be staying. The other thing is, the type of radio I have, again, is, yes, it is an SMA connector. It's a basically a UV5R variant called the VTEC UV5X3. And so I'm just thinking, there was a Nagoya antenna that people recommended for those tri-bands, but some people had mixed reviews, like they didn't think it was as good as the rubber ducky, and I'm expecting that you, Dick, might agree with that if you know about that antenna. Anyway, I appreciate... Oh, the other thing I wanted to mention is the reason I'm thinking this is because I am on Echolink now because I can hear you guys. I can hear this repeater, W2VL, on my radio, but it seems like I have failed to ever connect with it when I tried to transmit, and maybe I just haven't tried enough locations and stuff. So I know you guys are about 18 miles from me. I'm in Park Slope, Brooklyn. So I think that's all I have to say right now. So anyway, thank you so much for all your help, and if there's, you know, people more answers, or I welcome that too. This is Bob, KE2NVB.
WB2J, help me with another comment.
Bob number one, wait for the beep. Go right ahead, Bob number one.
Yeah, Bob number two, I heard you mention Nagoma. You got to be careful. There are counterfeit Nagoma antennas out there. The only way you can tell the difference is the label on the package. If it comes with a red label on it, it's a counterfeit antenna. If it has the blue label, it's supposedly a legitimate antenna over there. And I heard you mention the SMA, so you would need an adapter to go from the an SO239 to a male SMA, so this way you can hook up the whatever antenna you're going to use to your radio. That was my only comment. So if you're going to look in Nagoma, be careful which one you buy. And there's no way of knowing. I've got sunk already with buying the phony one, so there's no way of really knowing until you get it in your... In any case, that was my comment. Back to you, Dick.
Because the radio is a tri-band radio, 2 meters, 220, and 440, would make you want to buy an external antenna that's also a tri-band antenna. That may not be the wisest way to go. With a little bit of checking, you might find out that where you're going, there is no significant 220 repeater, so you're not going to be using 220. If you have an antenna that works on 2 meters and 440, that would be good enough. But just an external antenna itself doesn't necessarily mean everything's going to work better, unless that antenna is going to be mounted at a much higher location or external to the car as opposed to the rubber duck inside. As I said before, that rubber duck on the handy jockey in your hand at the right altitude is going to do what you want. And 13 miles is a, and particularly over water, 13 miles is a, usually a pretty easy path for a VHF, UHF repeater. There are a couple places in Brooklyn where this repeater produces a not the greatest reception, so that may not be your fault. It's just a function of the local terrain. Okay, good luck with that project, Bob, and let us know what you find out when you, if you decide to buy another antenna. Ed, K2GJE, was the next person who signed in. K2GJE, K2RIW, wait for the beep, and you got it, Ed.
Good evening, Dick. K2RIW, this is K2GJE. Just some commentary. I believe last Sunday night someone had some questions on original FM commercial broadcast. Would you like a little rundown on it? Over.
The price is right. Go right ahead, Ed.
Okay, thank you. Of course, we all credit Major Edwin Armstrong with bringing FM to commercial. He first presented it to the FCC 17th in 1936. And in January 5th of 1940, they assigned him 42 to
50 megacycles. That was the original FM band, 42 to 50 megacycles. He did have some stations running, and he did sell quite a number of FM receivers, which performed quite well. After the Second World War, Sarnoff petitioned the FCC to change the FM band. I don't want to go into that fully. So on June 27th of 1945, it was changed to what we now use, the 88 to 108. The excuse was more channels. It did give more channels, but it did basically put Armstrong out of business. Back to net, over.
So we got more megacycles, more channels, higher frequency, and my guess is that was done for economic reasons. He didn't necessarily want more channels. He wanted to put the competition out of business. Is that approximately what happened, Ed? Go ahead.
You hit the nail on the head. And when television came out after the war, as we all know, the audio is FM. Over.
Yes, 25 kilohertz deviation FM. Over 150 kilohertz for FM broadcast. And our audio is FM with our television. In the beginning, the British television was amplitude modulated on their audio, which is a little bit more interference vulnerable, and therefore the Brits did some very good work on static eliminating circuits, peak detecting circuits and whatever, to try to eliminate some of the static that they were picking up on their television amplitude modulated audio. Maybe Eric's going to tell us a few words on that, if he happens to be available. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Run that by me again, Nick.
Okay, our NTSC television, audio is FM modulated, 25KC. British television in the beginning, analog television, the audio was amplitude modulated. As such, the Brits did some pretty good work on making the static pickup, impulse noise and whatever, vulnerability of amplitude modulated audio. They made some pretty good static eliminating circuits on their AM television audio. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, the old 405 line system was AM. As far as like, you know, impulse noise reduction, that kind of thing, I'm not really familiar with it. Actually, the 405 line system, they actually stopped transmitting it, I guess, about 20 years ago. But, I'll look some of that up.
Even when they went away from the 405 system to the 625 line system, did they keep the audio amplitude modulated, or did they flip up into FM modulation for the audio that went with that picture? Over you, Eric.
Originally, in the original 625 line system, the four stereo was FM. I don't remember what the deviation, but when they went to stereo, they didn't do the same thing that we did. They went to a system called NICAM, which was considerably different. Our FM audio with stereo uses DBX. They did a pre-emphasis for the deviation that they had. I don't remember what it is, but it's a little bit different than what ours was.
Yeah, our stereo system, at least when it comes to FM broadcast stereo, 19KC pilot tone, 38KC suppressed subcarrier, upper and lower sideband, I think we're left plus right, or left minus right, is the way I think our system works. The British system for stereo, as a quick explanation, what do they do that's different, Eric? Go ahead.
ICAM had a different pilot frequency, and the matrixing of the, you know, deriving left and right was a little bit different. Ratios were different, I believe. And I have to check because, you know, I live in the United States, so it's not at the tip of my tongue.
But Eric, you're our latest, you're our local broadcast engineer, and you're supposed to know about all these worldwide systems and tell us about it. I'm having some fun with it. So, Eric, I thank you. I mean, Ed, thank you for that information. The next person who was on our list was Joe, the B2RYY, who apparently had some trouble getting in the beginning. Maybe everyone was stepping on him. The B2RYY, K2RYW, you got it, Joe.
It's funny how the pilot's radio seems to work. Intermittently, it's very funny. On my service monitor, works all the time, but every time I throw the check on here, it's very funny how it doesn't be heard sometimes, you know? I can't quite explain that. So anyway, paper here, see if I have some notes what I'm going to ask you on. And a cable that's a electrical quarter wave, slightly more than like about 0.28 wavelengths at a certain frequency. If you hook that to a T-connector, and you have the other part of that going from a signal generator to and then to a receiver, but you're putting a T-connector for you know, another purpose or something else in there, that cable will cause a short on the frequency and tend to lower the signal. Is that correct or incorrect?
Okay, there's multiple things you could be discussing here, Joe. One of the recent discussions of mine, which I'm about to write an article on, is with reference to PL-259, SO-239 connectors. Arguably, the best buy for the money is UHF connectors, PL-259, SO-239. In my opinion, they will easily tolerate, when you buy a good brand and install them correctly, you'll take 5 kilowatts of power. That's the good news. The bad news, they have an internal impedance of around 30 ohms instead of 50 ohms, which is a fancy way of saying that the connector is giving you an extra amount of capacitance during that length. Now, when you're using the antenna on HF frequencies, the length is so short, the fact that it's 30 ohms doesn't matter. If you want to use PL-259s, SO-239s for your moonbound transmitter, where you're running 1.5 kilowatts on either 2 meters or 450, that length of that connector, 1.78 inches, when you put a bunch of them together to make a splice, does give you some grief. If the bullet portion of a 59s on the ends of the cables you're splicing and the SO-239 in between, the female-female, and if that is a T connector, and if you're willing to put a quarter wavelength of cable as a short circuit stub, the short circuit stub is a shunt inductor. The connectors, because they're 30 ohms instead of 50 ohms, let me drop. I'm giving you an extra capacitance when you put an inductor, meaning the shunt, shorted shunt, quarter wave long, in parallel with the extra capacitance, the capacitance disappears. So you can take SO-239, PL-259 as a splicing device, and if you're willing to use a T connector in that splice, and you're willing to put in this quarter wavelength of cable of any impedance, 70 ohm, 50 ohm, of just the right length, it will remove the capacitance, and now inexpensively, you've got 5 kilowatt connectors. If you compare the price of that as a pair of using connectors that are really good for that power, like a 716 DIN connector, that can really tolerate the power, but those are expensive connectors. Most of the connectors that are really rated for multiple kilowatts are expensive connectors. SO-239, PL-259s can do it beautifully. If you're smart enough to tune out the capacitance by this T-connector and shunt, shorted shunt stub, and by the way, if you make the shorted stub instead of a quarter wavelength long at 2 meters, you make it 3 quarters of wavelength long at 2 meters, which means it's a quarter wavelength long at 450, you can simultaneously tune out the capacitance both on 2 meters and 450 simultaneously. So if you want to save money and have high power connectors, a smart guy using PL-259, SO-239, as a cable splice can do an awful lot for the money. Maybe that's what you're referring to, Joe. To B2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
I understood your explanation, but it has nothing at all to do with what I asked you. I'm just trying to equate what you said to what I asked you. It says no connection whatsoever.
Okay. A quarter wavelength of cable as a so-called impedance matching device. If I've got 70 ohm cable and I've got 50 ohm cable and I want to make the two together. If I put a quarter wavelength of 62 ohm cable in between the two,
input
but I didn't want the beats of the generator, or obstruction from the generator, loading down that circuit too much. I didn't want it to affect it too much. That's why I tried different lengths of cable. I just had discovered this actually by accident. That's what this, where this whole discussion is coming from. So it seems like a quarter wave shunts at one frequency and not others, and where a half wavelength seems to have a lot less effect on the performance at the frequency of the desired. As I said, my timer's 89 seconds, so I shouldn't time out to repeat if I let the button go. As I said, the 0.28 wavelength cable dropped down the signal level by 10 dB because I had to raise the generator 10 dB to get the signal back into receiver for what I previously had. At half, at 0.52, I dropped it down 4 dB. And a real long length of cable only dropped it down not even 1 dB. That was like 0.89 wavelength. That's all. That's what I was basically trying to find out here. Because as I said, I was testing a Motorola
repeater. Time out. Repeater. Time out. Cancel.
Yeah, when you get 89 seconds on your timer for your transmitter, and you drop out for a fraction of a second, that does not reset the timer on this repeater. You didn't wait for the beeps when you did that. So therefore, the last two transmissions, you timed out. Now, for whatever reason, you're using a T connector in the system, probably because you're trying to join two pieces of test equipment at one end of the cable. By usual definition, the T connector is taking a pair of 50-ohm cables, bringing them together, 25 ohms. So one end of the cable is possibly seeing a 25-ohm impedance. Other end of the cable is seeing that bugging device, which is giving you a 40 dB attenuation approximately, but that device on that end is almost a pure open circuit. So now you've got a piece of length of cable, you're changing the number of wavelengths of cable, and the brand name and whatever, and you've got a 2-to-1 VSWR on one end and an infinite VSWR on the other end. Obviously you're going to be extremely cable length sensitive. And it's not necessarily something magic about quarter wave, half wave, or whatever. Each length of cable, when mismatched on at least one end, has a predictable amount of impedance conversion, which you can plot on a Smith chart, or you can use equations to do that. A 2-to-1 standing wave ratio on a T connector with 25 ohms at one end, a quarter wave away, is going to still be a 2-to-1 VSWR, but it's going to be 100 ohms. You've converted 25 ohms on one end to 100 ohms on the other end by putting a quarter wave length of cable. So each length of cable, with each individual kind of, let me drop this. With each kind of mismatch, the mismatch might be the wrong impedance, like 25 ohms and 100 ohms, a mismatch because there's an extra capacitance or inductance. Each length of cable, with each kind of mismatch load on one end, is going to give you a predictable impedance on the other end. That predictable impedance, when plugged into your bug device, that's trying to give you a 40 dB attenuation, so to speak, that's going to have a different response. You can easily get the 40 dB of bug attenuation go to 30 or 50 dB, depending on what impedance you're presenting at that end, because of what you've done at the other end and the length of the cable. So, coaxial cable, or transmission lines in general, have got this crazy impedance converting phenomena. A given VSWR at one end of the cable sets up a Smith chart with a circle of a certain diameter, and as you change frequency and change length of cable, you're walking along that circle on the Smith chart. Dot on that circle is a different resistive and reactive component of presented impedance. So transmission lines have got this crazy impedance converting characteristic, which is frequency sensitive, length sensitive, impedance sensitive as to what you're doing on each end. That's what you're reconfirming with those experiments, in my opinion, Joe. I know it's not an easy one to absorb all of this the first time you hear it. The B2RYY. Wait for the beeps, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, the output of the tab is actually just 50 dB at UHF, so it works out to be about 60 or something like that. Maybe I think it's 60, almost 70 dB at 50 megahertz. But that's just immaterial, because I know what the generator level has to be to overcome that, because I know what the sensitivity of the receiver is. As I said, I was trying to hook up another piece of equipment, because once I had a short piece of cable off the T connector, level substantially. I tried different lengths and different lengths and changed it. They had a different effect on it, that's all. And I just have one question on this timer situation here. Why does the timer on this system have to be set by politics instead of reality?
I'm going to do the first question first. I'm going to ask you a direct question, Joe. When you set that bug tap device for a 40 dB attenuation, tell me what impedance your cable is seeing at that end, at the bug device end. Tell me what impedance do you believe a calibrated cable into a vector network analyzer. What is the impedance when you set it for 40 dB of attenuation, 40 dB of isolation? What do you believe is the impedance at that point, at that end? Give me a guess on that one, Joe. W2RYY, T2RIW.
Okay, I want to understand something. I don't know why you keep on saying 40 dB. Take that number and erase it. Okay? I'm not using 40 dB. Maybe that might be a favorite number you like to use. I told you, the tap is at 50 dB at UHF, at about close to 500 megahertz. And that's set with a 50 ohm terminator at the other end of the coupler. And the tap is set to get 50 dB down into a spectrum analyzer. And it works both ways. We put a signal in with a 50 ohm termination at the far end. You can see the level. It works both ways. Either coming and going out the tap. I did that for a specific reason to be able to drop that, then be able to use that to go into test equipment without blowing it up. And it works out to be about 70 dB as they take the frequency down to 70 megahertz. I'm not changing that tap's setting. That's set once. I set that once a long time ago. It's locked in place. I don't change it. It's not 40 dB. That's got nothing to do with the question I was originally asking about the cable length, okay?
Joe, you're missing my point. You hung up with the fact that I said 40 instead of 50. Al made believe I said 50. When you set that tapping device for 50 dB of isolation, the right kind of instrumentation, and you measure the impedance presented to the cable at that end, at the 50 dB isolation end, tell me what impedance do you think the cable is seeing at the input of that cable at that end, the 50 dB isolation device. What impedance do you think it is presenting? Over to you, Joe, K2RIW.
Probably very high impedance because it's an open circuit, like capacitive coupling.
Therefore, what is the standing wave ratio at that end?
I would think it's very high.
Bingo. You're seeing what I'm getting at. So you've got an extremely high standing wave ratio presenting to your cable at one end. That makes the impedance of the cable that it presents to the bug device, to the tapping device, very sensitive. In other words, small changes with the impedance presented from the cable at that end is going to take your 50 dB number and make it go higher and lower, lickety-split. Now, if the far end of that cable is a T connector going to more than one piece of test equipment, or if it's going to a receiver, for instance, rarely has a 50 ohm input impedance. A spectrum analyzer with a 10 dB attenuator at the front end, yes. Or a vector network analyzer, maybe. But a receiver, for instance, could have a pretty high input standing wave ratio. So when you've got a length of cable with an extremely high standing wave ratio at the end that has the 50 dB of isolation and some amount of standing wave ratio at the other end, now as you change frequency, change length of cable, change brand of cable, all hell is going to break loose. That's a very predictable phenomenon. Any length of cable mismatched at least at one end, and particularly if it's mismatched slightly at both ends, now you're very cable length sensitive, very impedance cable sensitive, very frequency sensitive. That's what I believe you're seeing, Joe. The B2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I knew that when I changed the different lengths. Obviously, the length has a lot to do with it. And I thought that the cable, the shorter length, being close to electrically a quarter wave at 50.5 megahertz, was causing an effect. And that's what I was asking. I was trying to recollect how that works. If it's an open quarter wave cable, it has a high impedance. It's the one end of the BNC. That's high impedance. That's on the top of this RF app. Okay, but the other end of the other percent of these BNC is going to a cable, which is going to the input of a mobile radio. So that's a rather low impedance that you're dealing with there. Accordingly, I saw this. I saw the link change. I saw it have an effect on the. It would pull the signal down. I had to raise the signal accordingly with different lengths. And I thought because it's a quarter wave, that's where the effect is coming from. It had really nothing to do with my measurements. I was just trying to not make my test equipment that I was adding to this piece of cable get in the way. I saw it loading it down, causing, you know, an unpredictable type of effect from happening. As I said, I was trying to test a noise blanker in a low-frequency radio.
Okay, you have a strong impedance mismatch at the 50 dB end. You have some amount of minor mismatch at the other end. And you would like to believe that there's a magic length of cable, quarter wave, half wave, three-eighths wave, whatever, that's going to make funny effects go away as a function of frequency and length of cable. Absolutely not. Only way you can make a transmission line non-length sensitive and non-frequency sensitive is for both ends of the cable to see exactly a 50-ohm resistor if it's a 50-ohm impedance cable. Only in that condition will the cable not be frequency sensitive and length sensitive. Perfect 50-ohm match on both ends. If either end, anything but a 50-ohm resistor, what's going to happen by way of Smith-Trott studies and whatever is predictable, but the first time you see it, it's strange. And so that 50 dB attenuation can easily become some other number because you're not 50 ohms terminated on both ends of that cable. So you'd like to believe that 0.28 wave or 0.25 wave is going to make this go away, or 0.50 wave is going to make it go away. Absolutely not. Every length of cable that is mismatched at least at one end is going to be cable length sensitive and frequency sensitive. That at first is going to seem strange. That's what you're reconfirming, Joe. Cables will only behave in a nice way if there's a 50-ohm resistor on both ends. The B2LYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
B2RIY. Well, I could have put terminations on it. I have assorted BNC terminators, or actually attenuators. I have threes, sixes, and so forth. Ones, threes, sixes. So I could put a combination. I could try like keep threes and sixes next time I set this thing up. Just to see if what you're saying, I do believe what you're saying is going to make any difference. But I brought this whole subject up just more or less as a curiosity type of thing. Was not to any push any further than that. But I will try the attenuators next time, just to see what effect it has on different cable lengths. Back to you.
Yeah, if you put a 10 dB attenuator, a high quality 10 dB attenuator, on both ends of that cable, then for the first time you'll find out that you're almost not cable length sensitive and frequency sensitive. And this is the main reason why when people in the old days used to set up a slotted line to do a very careful standing wave ratio measurement or impedance measurement, they placed a 10 dB attenuator on the output of the signal generator, then they went through a cable to the slotted line, and the far end of the slotted line went to the device on the test that they're trying to measure the impedance of with the slotted line. So even a high-quality signal generator, people were forced to put a 10 dB attenuator on the output of the signal generator because even a high-quality signal generator rated for 50-ohm source is a reasonably good 50-ohm source when you're setting it for, let's say, a minus 20 dBm of output. But if you're shy of power output, you crank that dial all the way up to the top end of, say, a Hewlett-Packard 608. When the Hewlett-Packard 608 signal generator is set for the maximum power output, I'll bet you that source impedance of that signal generator could be 15 ohms, and I'm not kidding. That distant attenuator, when you crank it to the high end, gives you some peculiar effects. So there's raw mismatches of cabling when doing careful slotted line measurements can drive you up a wall. Good luck with all those experiments, Joe. I'm going to go over to Eric next. He said he's got a question. KE2EJ. K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
I have a comment, WHCDO.
PM, please.
Okay, we had a triple that time. Andy, you wanted to make a comment? Go ahead, Andy.
Okay, good evening. I've been listening in like I normally do, and hello to everyone, and had a great day today, and a nice picnic. And we had a little hidden transmitter hunt, which I could talk about because I was using a beam antenna to track down the transmitter and had to make some modifications. But I think, Dick, what you're saying about attenuators, whenever I tune a duplexer, I always put a 3 dB pad on the ends of the cable going to the duplexer on all ports. And that's because I don't know what the impedance is, and I want to keep the impedance constant. And I find that I can tune in a duplexer a lot easier if I use those little attenuators. And as far as attenuation, it makes very little difference because of the level of the signal I'm putting in the first place, as far as tuning is concerned. But that mainly keeps the impedance looking from the duplexer into the impedance that it's looking into. It keeps it constant at 50 ohms because these are 50 ohm attenuators, by the way, just to let you know. And it does work quite well doing that. Make sense?
K2RY. That's a smart thing to do, Andy. And one of the things that's really crazy is you could have perfect instrumentation. Signal generator, well plated, so it's a pure 50 ohm source. All instrumentation, well plated, so it's a pure 50 ohm source. You do a careful alignment of a duplexing filter so that between the transmit frequency and the receive frequency, you have 100 dB of isolation, transmit to receiver. You can set up a duplexer that way, so the duplexer is essentially perfectly aligned. Then you connect the duplexer to a real antenna, where the real antenna has, let me pick a number, a 1.5:1 standing wave ratio. Depending on the cable length, phase angles, and whatever, your 100 dB of isolation could become some other number because of the impedance of that antenna presenting a reactance back to that duplexer. It's not going to kill it. The 100 dB is not going to go to 20. It may go to 105 or to 93. But filters are very impedance sensitive into what is their source of signal and what is the load of the signal. Are they exactly 50 ohm resistors? That's what I think you're confirming, Andy. To the A2CDL, K2RIW, the TechNet.
K2RY.
And 2EO. Okay, and we got the KG2OY and 2EO also, as you know. Yes, yeah, because I'm looking at the 50 ohms in all directions. At least my system, my RF system, antenna, radio, filters, duplex, or whatever it is, it's all a 50 ohm system. So I want to keep the 50 ohms, so that's why I put those pads in, and it's just a technique that I've been doing, and I found that if I don't use the pads, there is a change. I can't give you an actual number of how much of a change there is, but it makes it, after I tune the duplexer and place it into the system, there is no adjustments that I have to make. That was the most important thing that I noticed. That in the past, if I did not tune the duplexer using a 50 ohm pad or whatever it is, maybe even a 1 dB pad, as long as I'm going into 50 ohms, because I don't know what the rest of the system is like looking, what it looks into, I don't know what the impedance is, then I find that I don't have to make any adjustments doing it that way as compared to placing it into the system and then having to tweak the filters or whatever I'm using. If I'm not doing it that way, so it does make it easier to tune, and I do notice that difference. Okay, and it was just that the comment I wanted to make. All right, back to you, and thanks, WDCDO.
Hey, through, Jack. Sounds like Eric wants to make a comment on this exact subject. Go ahead, Eric.
And all I want to say that Randy's doing is kind of the right way, because if you look at the fluorescent beams of like the IFRs or the Hewlett Packard that I use, it's not exactly 50 ohms, depends on the frequency, and also how you have the attenuator set within the unit. So at least the fluorescent beams, the attenuator is a good way to maintain that 50 ohm impedance. Chances are most of the repeaters that you're dealing with, the output impedance of the amplifier that's going to be feeding the duplexer tends to be around 50 ohms. Sometimes it's 52, sometimes it's 48, in that neighborhood, which does make a difference in terms of how the filter reacts to it. So that it really is a good procedure. So yes, when you hook the antenna up to it, it's a little bit of an unknown factor, but you know, if you're dealing with 100 dB of isolation, which is a little hard to get from some of these duplexes, but you're doing the average, which is 90, you will notice a difference if you try to use the source impedance of the generator alone.
If you're using real good laboratory instrumentation with 50 ohm sources and loads everywhere while aligning a duplexing filter, and you've done a perfect job of aligning the filter, the duplexer, and you've got 100 dB of isolation between transmitter and receiver port, you've got very low insertion on the receiver total path, maybe 1.5 dB, and maybe 1.5 dB of loss on the transmitter path to the antenna, everything lined up just right. Then you take that duplexing filter and put it into the real system with a real antenna that's not exactly 50 ohms resistive, a real transmitter that's not exactly 50 ohms resistive, and a real receiver that's not exactly 50 ohms resistive. And by various techniques, you can find out what is the now installed isolation. And the 100 dB you had might be 94 dB, so to speak. If you're willing to retouch the tuning of the duplexing filter, a minor amount of retouching, you can get it under that real installed environment back to the 100 dB of isolation. But there's a catch. Let me drop it. There's a net in progress right now for the person who's doing testing. The method by which you inject signals in order to find out what is the resultant isolation in the installed performance, you've got to be careful. In order to inject a signal, you might say, well, I'll just put a directional coupler between the antenna and the duplexing filter to inject a signal and so that I can measure isolations and insertion losses. Or I do the same thing by putting a directional coupler or a sampling device on the transmitter port or the receiver port. You might be very tempted to do that so you can inject signals and re-measure isolation. By the fact that you've changed the cable length by injecting that coupler or that sampling device, change the presented impedance. So you have to, in installed performance, you've got to really not disturb the installed performance. In order to inject a signal, you may have to put a sniffer antenna near the station master to inject a signal without disturbing its impedance. You may have to find some other way of injecting a signal at the receiver port or the transmitter port of the system in order to remeasure, in order to do the tweaking. You got to be very, very careful, because any method of changing the cable length by a minor amount to these devices is going to change by the Smith-Trout rotation phenomenon, if you know what I mean. Any transmission line that's not perfectly 50 ohm matched at both ends of the transmission line becomes cable length sensitive and frequency sensitive. Let me drop it.
So is my test good or not good?
Your test is good, but you're interrupting a net that's in progress. So that there are ways of readjusting to tweak it for the installed performance, but you've got to be very, very careful as to how you do it. And drop it.
Repeater, timeout.
Get over it.
Thank you for the radio.
Kite G2RY. We're going to get to you in a minute, Dave. There's a guy ahead of you. There are ways of retweaking it for the installed performance, but you've got to be very, very careful as to how you do it. Methods by which you inject signals and measure the performance has to be done in a way that does not disturb the impedance that the three things present to to the duplexing filter. The antenna, the transmitter, and the receiver. You don't want to disturb those impedances in indoor performance that are presented to the filter. But when the filter sees anything but a 50-ohm load on the receiver port, the transmitter port, or the antenna port, the tuning of that duplexing filter and its isolation has changed. And so that's the laws of physics. I think, let's see, KG2LY, do you have a comment on the subject that's on the floor right now? KG2LY, K2LIW. Go ahead, David.
I don't know if I'm like smart enough to participate in this net, but I just want to say that would this subject be directly related to like connecting coaxial cable through RF output? Because, you know, I had to add an extension, you know, to connect my HF radio to my fan dipole, and I had maybe 6 or 7 different kinds of wire to connect it to with different kinds of connectors, and each one gave me different results until I finally found the right one that worked the best. Just to keep it simple, is that sort of what you're talking about?
If you were using nothing but 50-ohm cables, for instance, we're changing the length of cable and brand name of cable and so on. If the signal generator was a perfect 50-ohm source, and if the antenna was a perfect 50-ohm resistive load, that one environment, you would not be cable length sensitive. If the signal generator is anything but 50-ohm resistor, if the antenna is anything but a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio, if you have any standing wave ratio at either end of a transmission line, then you will be cable length sensitive and frequency sensitive, meaning that change the length of the cable, the insertion loss of the system will change. Change the frequency, and the insertion loss of the system will change. Transmission lines are not length sensitive and not frequency sensitive if and only if they have pure 50-ohm resistor on each end simultaneously, if it's a 50-ohm cable, or if it's a 450-ohm ladder line. It wants to see a 450-ohm resistor on each end. So transmission lines are very predictable if and only if they have the exact resistive impedance on each end simultaneously. Other than that, things are going to change versus length, change versus frequency. In a way that's strange at first, but if you're smart enough with the mathematics or a Smith chart, it is all predictable. It's not just a random variable where somebody has rolled the dice, if you know what I mean. If it's smart enough, it's all predictable. KG2LY, K2LIW. Go ahead, David.
2LIW, KG2LY. Fine business, but, you know, I have one more short question with this exact subject. You know, I find that my signal strength and SWR changes when it rains. Is there something going on? Is water getting into the cable? Does that have something to do with the overall impedance of the system?
In general, David, the answer is yes. Air has a dielectric constant of 1. Water has a dielectric constant of 81. One drop of water in the middle of a type N connector, or 2 drops of water in the middle of a UHF connector, change the impedance at particularly VHF frequencies by a whole lot. That's normal. And UHF connectors give you a lot of bang for the dollar. That's the good news. But a UHF connector is not weatherproof. Use a UHF connector outdoors. You have to do some heroic things to keep the water from getting into that connector. There is no rubber seal in there. Water can walk through the threads, walk into that connector, and do all kinds of funny things. And water has a huge dielectric constant at RF frequencies. And particularly at UHF frequencies, water is a very lossy material. A couple of drops of water in the middle of a type N connector at 432 megacycles can easily give you 10 decibels of extra loss. And you think you're going to boil that water out by putting a whole lot of power through that connector? Absolutely not. Let me drop. You still start turning that water into steam, and the steam goes roaring down the cable and doing all kinds of funny things, particularly if it's a foam-filled cable. So don't try to boil water out of the connector. You have to open up the connector and completely dry out the water by other means. So water at any of our RF frequencies, waters and connectors are pretty troublesome. Rarely is that a good thing, if you know what I mean. Now, the next person on our list was Eric, KE2EJ. Eric, I think you wanted to ask a question or give us some information. You got the floor, Eric. KE2EJ, our broadcast engineer, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. We'll get to my question in a second. I just want to give you some information I've looked up. 405 lines, okay. The channel bandwidth was 5 megahertz. The video bandwidth was 3 megahertz. The sound carrier was below the picture carrier by 3.5 megahertz, and it was AM. Anything that's positive modulation had an AM audio carrier. UK, the system that they use, the 625 line, it's got a channel bandwidth of 8 megahertz. The video bandwidth is 5 megahertz. Actually, it's 5.5 megahertz. The sound carrier, now in England, it's 5.996 megahertz above, and it's FM. Now, when they went to stereo, they used something called NICAM. Stands for Near Instantaneous Companded Audio Multiplex. And basically, it was a digital format. It's an early form of PCM. It's only 14 bits big. It ran about 700 kilohertz in terms of sample rate. And they continue to transmit mono FM along with that. And as you know, in Europe, each country decided to use a different standard so that way you couldn't pick it up in the neighboring country, which might only be miles away from each other. So that's some of the answers to what you were asking before. And as far as how they did improvements to the AM modulation, they built noise blankets into the, trying to get rid of the impulse noise. I mean, it dropped. Okay. Now, my question to you. Are you familiar with dielectric resonator oscillators?
Barium tetratitanate resonator on UHF frequencies? Yes, I've worked with those quite a bit. Eric, go ahead.
Hi. I came into a bunch of LMBs that are at 12 gigs, and they were actually designed for the Intel SATs, which run about 100 megahertz higher. Higher? 100 megahertz? Lower, sorry. And what I'm trying to do is to pull out the existing resonators and file them down to move them up 100 megahertz. And I think I had success with one of them. Not an easy task. You got any tricks, an easy way to do it? Easy way to move it?
I've never moved any of them, Eric. The actual resonator itself, the puck, as it's called, I think it's a very hard piece of ceramic-like material, which has a very specific shape. And in order to lap it, in order to change its dimensions, to change its resonant frequency, and keep its Q, its extraneous frequency resonance is controlled. I think that's an art form. Many of them have a tuning control, which is a disc that you bring nearby. And as the disc comes closer, you're presenting a shunt. And I believe the shunt, in most cases, raises the frequency. Or there, I'm not sure. I think it raises the frequency as you bring your shunting device close by. But there's only a small amount of frequency movement you can do with that before you start developing either a decharacteristic or very mechanical sensitive. You may bring the desk, the tuning device, within a thousandth of an inch, and now you could become extremely temperature sensitive because as the temperature changes a couple of degrees, let me drop it. As the temperature changes a couple of degrees centigrade, the dimensions of the container are changing by thousandths of an inch or millionths of an inch, and therefore the gap that you carefully adjusted is going to change, and therefore you're going to get a brand new frequency. So moving the frequency of a dielectric resonator in my opinion, is not easy. I don't remember seeing articles of people